All right. Welcome to the robotic seminar. Today we are very happy to have our own Awi Chasid, faculty in the Robotics Institute. Howie, of course, needs no introduction, but I'll do it anyway. He has been working with really cool robots for a long time, and he has, you know, numerous, if you read the bio, you know, best paper awards, and he appeared on TV shows and radio, I guess, as well. And you know, he's been here and there. And here is a mathematical question for you. At least 5 years ago, the MIT Technology Review has elected Howie as one of the top innovators under the age of 35. So at least 5 years ago, he was at least he was less than 35. Given that information, how old is his son? Anyone? Well, I'll tell you, because I did my calculations on the back here. His son, who is named Malik, is 5 weeks and 2 days old. He wanted to come here, but he had other things to do, so he's sending his apologies. Instead, he has sent his mother, Beth, in his place. And we are very excited to have Howie talk about his new stuff.
Hi, thank you. Thank you. It was a nice, it was a very kind introduction. I'm really happy to be here, very happy. I like Carnegie Mellon, particularly the community in the Robotics Institute, because we do a lot in multidisciplinary research. You know, we draw from many disciplines and bring them together nicely, and we focus on fielded systems. Whether we have an application in mind or a novel a mechanism that we want to see work, it's something that we really spend a lot of effort making it see happen, and that goes back and helps define our research efforts. With that in mind, the research that my group has been doing over the past few years, well, we've been building a lot of robots, particularly snake robots. We also like building robots that fall. And just building the robots by themselves is not enough. We sort of look at the underlying math, the underlying theory behind them to make these robots go. Likewise, we've also been inspired by some applications, let's say car painting, to drive some of the theoretical contributions that we've made. And again, it's not just saying, hey, we're interested in car painting. We actually go work on the factory floor with the painters just to see how that could impact our theory. Now, this balance of implementation and underlying theory is something I like to bring into my advising, as well as some of the courses, notably this undergraduate LEGO robotics course that I teach. And if I have time, I'll try and show some videos of that. Now, the research that we've been doing over the last few years touches on two foci, highly articulated systems like snake robots and tasks that involve coverage. And these foci have given rise to, say, four research problems that we've been interested in. So the first is path planning. And how do we coordinate all of the degrees of freedom of a system in order to maneuver around obstacles to achieve a task? Now, sometimes we don't have full control of all the variables, all of our degrees of freedom. So the question is how can we coordinate our remaining internal degrees of freedom just to make the robot go in some direction? Usually, these gate generation, these control techniques, don't respect obstacles. So what we want to do is combine our path planning and our locomotion work, where we can do locomotion while avoiding obstacles. And we're going to do this in this hybrid controls framework. Naturally, the path planning and control work we need requires feedback. And we've been doing a lot of work in estimation for our path planning and behaviors, sort of put this whole thing together. So let's talk about snake robots first. I think snake robots are a good mechanism that sort of tie together the path planning, control, estimation, and the hybrid controls. I'm really glad Felix is here, because maybe I hit the wrong button. I don't even know how to do that in PowerPoint if I tried.
Telekinesis.
Okay, if it happens again, I'm going to throw this away. So what's nice about snake robots is they have some very nice applications: urban search and rescue, minimally invasive surgery, battlefield medicine, etc. But what's also nice is that the many degrees of freedom, which provide their benefits, also introduce some interesting research problems, and you know, in mechanism design, path planning, etc. So let's talk about some mechanism design at first. Believe it or not, over the last 10 years, there have been a lot of snake robots built, more than you can shake a stick at. And pretty much these designers, when they're thinking about what they want in their robot, they're sort of making these trade-offs between size, strength, and maneuverability. And it seems to me that that's what they're trying to fight. And in our work, I think we break some of these trade-offs. Now, I should point out that we've been inspired by Mark Yim's Polybots and Nobuaki Takanashi's design, which has appeared in the NEC and JPL snake robots. These robots are essentially 2-degree of freedom universal joints that are stacked up on top of each other. Now, part of the problem with those joints is that the point of actuation, where'd my mouse go? Okay. The point of actuation usually occurs at the center of the device. So that's why there's a lot of backlash. That's why there's a lot of weakness. So what we decided to do was put our actuation, our point of actuation, at the periphery of the device, allowing for the mechanical advantage to give us some more strength. So here, this is our robot Snoopy. There's a mobile base here. Just judge us above the waist, not the mobile base. And essentially, what we have are these 2-degree of freedom robots joints that are actuated by these linear actuators, these novel push-pull mechanisms. One pushes this way, one pushes that way. That gives us our full 2 degrees of freedom. Here, what we've done is we actually deployed this in an actual mock urban search and rescue training exercise with the Indiana Task Force 1 and the Chemical Biological Incident Response Force, it's part of the Marines, with Robin Murphy and Kraysar, which is now graduated into this other center called the Safety, Security, Response, and Research Center. This is one application that my group, we really spent a lot of time on. In fact, one of my members, Jason Geist and myself, were actually responders as part of Robin's response team if we're ever invited to go with robots. Here's another application that we're doing with Tatrick over here. This is one of our battlefield medicine. The idea is there's this life support, trauma, and transport unit. The idea is if one of our soldiers is hurt as we're dragging him through the field, you may be able to perform some diagnostics and therapeutics on him as he's before he gets to the MASH hospital. The idea is that Tatrick wanted us to put a snake arm on this robot, not because we want to be able to maneuver through highly convoluted spaces, but more because we want to access a lot of locations with a very small envelope. Because as you're dragging someone through the battlefield, you don't want the robot, a big giant robot saying, hey, there's someone who's hurt here. Now, this robot's nice, it's stronger, but we kind of graduated to this Cadillac of snake robot joints where, again, here's our actuator, here's our regular gear, here's an inverted bevel gear or some sort of bevel gear train, and the point of actuation occurs once again at the periphery, and this gives us incredible strength. In fact, we iterated on this design a few times where not only do we have some great strength, but we also have this nice range of motion. Actually, it's plus or minus 120 degrees in both degrees of freedom, which is unprecedented for a robot joint, let alone a snake robot joint. And you can see that, you know, if we really want, this robot can go down, touch its base, wrap around. The problem with this robot, however, I guess the same problem with lots of Cadillacs, is that it's very complicated and it broke down a lot. So what we did is we returned back to our universal joint design over here, where now our universal joint is essentially 2 sector gears that are arranged at 90 degrees. And by actuating each of these sector gears, we're able to get a nice range of motion, certainly not as much as we had before. But what's also nice is our link length is a lot shorter. So shorter link length, nice range of motion, gives us a lot of maneuverability, once again, in 3 dimensions. And we're going to put this on another mobile base, and we're hoping to use this in some search and rescue training with White Oaks in the near future. Now, this design we actually integrated in a robot that SAIC developed. They developed this novel skin actuator. It's sort of like those water wiggles. You ever those toys you had when you were a kid? You grab it and it pops out of your hand. Well, they made a robot version of that. And working closely with them, we've been able to sort of steer their water wiggle robot around, however we want. You know, this is one thing that we're very proud of over here, that this robot, you know, for whatever peace-loving, fence-breaching need you may have, it may have, but it's still a nice demonstration of the technology. I think some of you may know David Anhalt, who comes here a lot. Now, so far the robots, you know, I've been using the term snake robots. I'm using the term snake robot, but really these devices have a fixed base. So just taking it up a notch, you know, those were the medium-sized robots. We have this task with Boeing to create a mechanism that can fold up in a nice little corner, reach into a wing box, reach out over 12 feet with a 20-pound payload, and put rivets into the side of the wing box. Right now, they have a guy who sort of climbs in, and he doesn't like his job. So we want to be able to automate that. So naturally, the challenge is, you know, how do you make the robot nice and strong? We've tried this, or we've adopted this SCARA-type design, where the axes are perpendicular to the gravity vector. So really, our joints, all they have to do is just the bearings. All they have to do is just withstand gravity. And you can see here, at 6 feet, we're able to move a nice 35-pound payload around. What's kind of funny is the real innovations, we think, aren't in the snake robot, but it's at the wrist. So we've also designed this nice, compact, 3-degree of freedom wrist with which we can apply the rivets. And when we apply the rivets, the end effector actually has a strong magnet that sticks very tightly to the wing box. And once it's attached, it's really kind of hard to move. So if you get the positioning off by a little bit, you're kind of screwed. So we've developed this novel actuator where this is a disc, and but the disc is connected in this piston, but it's off-centered. So when we push down really hard and start to rotate the motor, because of the eccentricity, we can move the end effector just a little bit, fine-tuning the positioning to get the rivet into the right spot. So I told you about the medium robots, and I told you about the large robots. I think some of you who know me well enough know I like McDonald's. So there's small, medium, and large. So going to the small size robot, in collaboration with Marco Zanatti at the University of Pittsburgh and other people there, Dr. Ota in particular, we've been able to make a very small snake robot for minimally invasive surgery. So I think the idea of minimally invasive surgery doesn't require that much motivation. I think we all agree it's going to happen, or it's happening. But the thing is, with minimally invasive surgery, you really only have two choices of tools: those which are rigid and linear, okay, or those that are flexible, but they buckle very easily. Those are good for going in the luminal spaces, say your intestines. What we want is the best of both worlds, something that's both rigid and flexible, and that's what this robot is over here, this small, highly articulated robot probe. Now, what's kind of cool is, again, I told you this is good for minimally invasive surgery, and the video I just showed you, I really wouldn't say that was minimally invasive, because it was cut open and the pig was bleeding a lot. But just to show you, we are doing real minimally invasive surgery. Over here, we made two. Marco and Take, they made two incisions into the pig, one for the snake robot and one for a laparoscope that we just shoved in so we can see what's going on. Right now, we're still in the process of perfecting our visualization. So you're probably wondering, why did I make this figure so small and hard to see? Because this is what we see too. So I figured you should have a taste of that. So right now, what we have is the snake robot is riding above the heart in the pericardium sac. So there's sort of a see-through. The pericardium is sort of see-through. And right over here, you can see there's the tip of the snake robot. And coming out of the tip is an ablation tool. So we were able to use a conventional ablation tool in order to perform an ablation procedure on this pig. Now, if the pig was suffering an arrhythmia, I'm sure this would help him. But I don't think he was suffering an arrhythmia. Okay. So these are our fixed-base snake robots, the small, medium, and large. And I keep using the term snake robot, but maybe I should show you things that really do creep and crawl like real snakes. Now, before I go on, I should say that in addition to the great graduate students we have here at Carnegie Mellon, there's a wonderful community of talented and dedicated undergraduates here that they have this robotics club, they teach their own courses. It's a really great community. And a battalion of these people have been working very, very hard in my lab to make these devices, you know, really creep and crawl like snake robots. What these things are single degree of freedom units that are daisy chained together, and they're powered by hobby servos, except these hobby servos are on steroids. What we've been able to do is crack open the servos, take out the electronics, put our own electronics in, making them stronger, safer, more reliable, and addressable so they can work on a computer bus. But I think what's more impressive than the engineering technology, which again, I'm just in complete awe. You know, I still do not get bored at looking at these robots work live. You know, I really enjoy giving demos, because you know, I find what they've been able to do is this very, very inspiring, just to see these things work and swim, climb stairs. But the thing is, what I think is impressive is all these behaviors that they've been able to come up with really has been guided by their intuition. Okay, it's because we have some really smart people and hardworking people is why we can make these robots go so well. So I'm kind of curious, you know, what could someone like me do in order to design these gates? So, and more importantly, we want to understand, you know, why these things work so well. So what we're going to do is take a step back and, let's see. I don't know why it's not going. So what we want to do is take a step back and start to look at some of the fundamental mechanics behind these systems. Now, what a lot of people do in this field is they pick a system that's simple enough that it's tractable. It's something that we can do some sort of computation on, yet it's more complicated that in doing these calculations, there's something that we're able to learn, something new we can learn. And what we've done is we've arranged these systems on a spectrum where on the far left, we have systems, mechanical systems, that are governed solely by conservation of momentum. So if you want, you can think of these guys as like a planar falling cat. Okay? The cat only uses conservation of momentum to fall. On the other side of this spectrum, we have systems that only use their non-holonomic constraints, the interaction of the mechanism with the environment, in order to propel themselves forward. So this is more like a snake maybe crawling on a rock. But these are just endpoints of a spectrum. There's a whole host of systems that lie in between where they use both conservation momentum and their non-holonomic constraints in order to go forward. So one popular device is this snake board, which I think some of you have seen. We added another device called the variable inertia snake board because its inertia changes and it's still a snake board. Now, what a lot of people have done over the years is they provided analysis tools where they can dream up a gate and then see if that gate works. Now, the gates that they dreamt up all had to be sinusoidal inputs. So system, and that kind of makes sense. Systems that that oscillate, a gate is something that oscillates, so it makes sense that sine is probably one of your best sinusoidal functions, or one of your best periodic functions. A whole host of work has been done, and our work builds upon this. So what I want to do now is I want to go into a little bit of detail into some of the gate generation techniques that we've developed. So when analyzing these systems, it makes sense to look at Lagrange's equations to get the equations of motion. Now, if we have the equations of motion of a system, and you tell me what the inputs are, what the forces are, going and simulating how the system is going to evolve, how the system is going to move, that's a pretty straightforward, easy thing to do. What we want to do is the opposite. What we want to do is we want to say, okay, what are the inputs we need in order to make the system go forward? And that is a very complicated question, a very complicated problem. So what we're going to do now is we're going to see how can we simplify this problem. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to assume that our mechanical systems obey have a trivial fiber bundle structure. What that means is that we can very cleanly divide our configuration variables into shape variables, internal shape variables, and external position variables. So one set of variables, that's these G's, that's where the system's located at. And then these R's, these are the variables representing the internal shape of the system. So maybe what we want to do is we want to figure out what would be a formula, you know, for our internal shape variables to make us move in some direction. So we're going to make this separation. Now, we'll assume that we can fully control our internal shape variables. We'll just say we're godlike. We can tell we can just dictate the positions and velocities of our internal shape variables. So all we have to now worry about are the differential equations associated with the position variables. So the next thing that we're going to do is we're going to observe that we have this property of invariance. And what that means is that we can write the Lagrangian at any group element or any position element in the space, and it won't change the Lagrangian. Essentially, what we're saying is that the body frame or the inertial frame can move to wherever we want, which makes sense. Conservation of momentum, you can move your frame anywhere you want, and momentum is still going to be conserved. So by writing the Lagrangian at the identity element of this group, we're able to come up with this nice form of a momentum equation, which is now a first-order differential equation. So we've taken our second-order differential equation, our Lagrange's equations, we pretend we can control our internal shape variables, so those second-order systems go away, and we've ended up with this nice first-order differential equation, which is for momentum, which tells us how our system moves. Now the thing is, this first-order differential equation actually is still not quite pretty. What we did is, if you look at this equation long enough, you can see using some first-order differential equation theory, there's this thing called an integrating factor that you can use to further simplify your differential equation to end up with this nice, easy-to-solve differential equation, which is just a function of our velocities, a matrix, and then again, a function of our internal velocities. So now, going back to our understanding of what momentum looks like and an equation for our non-holonomic constraints, we can combine those to come up with this equation called the reconstruction equation. People have derived this in different ways. Ours is actually a nice straightforward use of linear algebra. So what this equation tells us is that our position velocities are a function of our internal shape velocities and our scaled momentum. Of course, there's this linear map and this other linear map over here. So if we want to start to designing gates, we can realize that this is position velocity, this is displacement, it's the integral of position velocity. It has two contributions, a geometric component, which corresponds to this first term, and a dynamic component, which corresponds to this second term. And looking at this equation, this is where, using this equation, we can now actually go out and design gates. And what's nice is we can design gates for the full spectrum of these systems. Now, purely mechanical systems and principally kinematic systems, these are the extremes. If you start off with zero momentum, then this term will always be zero. So what I want to do now is just explain how to derive gates for these two types of systems. It's a nice easy first step, and then we'll generalize to the full thing. So right now, we're only considering this first part here. So remember, a gate is a cycle in your internal shape variables. So if you look at this plot here, let's consider a system with two internal shape variables. Let's say a three-link robot, two internal joints. Here's joint one, here's joint two. A circle corresponds to one revolution of a gate, one period of your gait, because what you've done is you started and stopped at the same location. So when you're walking, let's say, all your knee, your hip, your ankles, they start and stop at the same location, but yet you have a net displacement. So looking at this reconstruction equation, now our dynamic term is zero. When we go and look at the right-hand side of this equation, it has this nice one form, which allows us to use Stokes' theorem. So instead of looking at a path integral along this gate here, what we're able to do is look at a volume integral to figure out how much displacement we have. So this matrix here, this A matrix, what we do is we plot each row of that matrix. So each row of that matrix, we'll call it a height function. Naturally, this height function has points that are 0 and points which are positive and points which are, of course, negative. What you'll do is you'll draw a closed path inside of one of these height functions such that if you can envelop a big bump, then you're getting more offset. Okay? So just to drive this point home, if you were to draw this nice circle over here, this nice sinusoidal input actually, since the amount of negative volume equals the amount of positive volume, you'll get no displacement because what's positive balances out what's negative. So the name of the game is try to get as much sine volume in one direction as possible. Also note this figure 8 here. Well, when you crisscross this 0 line here, because of the handedness of the Stokes theorem, since you're now changing directions, going from clockwise to counterclockwise, what's positive is now negative, and what's negative is now positive. So here you're gaining offset on both sides of the equation, so you get to move forward. So in this example here, this is the three-link robot that we started off with. It only has one; it has two internal shape variables. This is its height function, and you can see that this cyan gate here that I'm going around envelops this deep dimple, this deep valley. So that gives us a lot of motion just in the orientation direction. This figure 8, okay, yeah, it crosses the 0 set, but we're getting a lot of negative and a lot of double negative, a lot more negative again. That gives us another gate. And we can see, you know, this actually turns. Now, for the principally kinematic system, the one that's governed just by its non-holonomic constraints, there are two height functions we have to worry about, one for the x direction and one for orientation. Here, what we've done is we've drawn a figure 8 that's fully enclosed inside of one region, so it'll have no offset in the x direction. And we have another figure 8. It's the same figure 8 superimposed on the theta height function, which crosses the 0 set, so we get some offset over here and some other offset over there. And you can see the result is we get this robot that's able to orient. So what's nice here is, I think here's an example of where human intuition by itself really won't be enough in order to make the robot go the way you want to go. I mean, maybe you can make it go sideways, but I don't think a person can really play with the inputs in order to get this mechanism to rotate. Right. Yes?
So I'm a little confused. Calling that non-holonomic, because I look at the video, it's slipping quite a bit.
Ooh, yes, it is slipping quite a bit.
Is that part of the plan, or is that an accident, or?
Ooh, we cheated. Okay, this is an excellent subtle point. So, if we go and plot the height function for thanks, Chris. If you go and plot the height function over here, what really will happen is because of these non-holonomic constraints, the height function actually goes to infinity. Okay, since we don't have enough room to draw the height function going all the way to infinity, we drew the arctangent of the height function, just to get things nice and small. So what we did then is we said, well, it is passing through that singularity. Let's just draw the gate and see what happens, you know, and observe what happens. So we drew the gate, passed through the infinity point, and then we went and tried it on the real system. And lo and behold, you know, the universe was kind to us and it worked. But it didn't quite work all the way. If you noticed, the wheels slid a little bit. So when the wheels were sliding, what was happening is we're passing through that singularity, and that's where we're sort of breaking away from the true nature. Yeah, good eye. So any questions so far? So now what I want to do is I want to return back to this dynamic component. So the first thing we're going to do is look for the set of positions. Look for the set of integral joint velocities where the momentum actually goes back to 0. So what that does is it creates a vector field on our space, on our height functions, where if we respect that vector field is defined by solving this differential equation equal to 0. Where if we respect that vector field, the flow of that vector field, we can both simultaneously look to where we can get some height or get some volume in our height functions, and at the same time locomote. So again, it still has this momentum equal to 0. And that's sort of what Francesco and friends did when they were working on analyzing the snake board. However, we want to do the full-blown thing. So here, what we do is, again, we plot our height functions just like so. We try and draw a gate in our height function that we think is happy. So in this case here, we're trying to orient. So we find the right gate, which gives us offset and orientation, but not in x and y. And then we take that exact gate, and we superimpose them on each of the rows for this gamma function. So here, this is where it's starting to become a little bit hackish. All we're doing is we're taking gates that are geometric formulation asked us to do, and then we check to see if they're always in a positive or negative region on these gamma functions. We can't use the same trick with Stokes' theorem here because the formulation here is not a one-form. But what we are able to do is if we design a gate which, say, moves us in the x direction, when we superimpose that gate, on our x gamma function, as long as it's fully contained in, say, a positive region the whole time, we know, at the very least, it's only going to contribute to that direction. So we don't know how much we're going to locomote, but we still know we're going to keep locomoting in that direction. So everything I've described so far for gate generation doesn't respect the existence of obstacles. It's just pretty much we're able to go in one direction, another direction, or orient. So what I want to do now is I want to change gears to path planning, which respects obstacles but assumes you can control all of your degrees of freedom. So a lot of you who know me know I like these Voronoi diagrams. They're the set of points equidistant to these two objects. And what's nice about them is that since they're defined in terms of distance, if you have a mobile robot, let's say, that's exploring an unknown space, range sensors give you distance information. You can use that to develop control laws, which can allow you to systematically construct these edges and explore a space. Now, in my thesis, we lifted this into three dimensions, where instead of being equidistant to two obstacles, we're equidistant to three obstacles. So here, this red line corresponds to the set of points that are equidistant to the floor, the ceiling, and in this case, the side wall. Unfortunately, the structure is not connected, so you have to do a lot of stuff to connect up that structure. And it really looks sloppy. It looks really messy, actually. I spent a long time trying to make it look nice, but in the end, it looks sloppy. And a few years ago, we realized that this sloppiness is a fact of life. If you look in homotopy theory, there's this result that says there is no deformation retract of a three or more dimensional space. In other words, there's no way to continuously retract a three or more dimensional space down to a one-dimensional representation. In the plane, you're able to do that, but in three or more dimensions, you're not able to. So from there, I kind of wave my hands and say, aha, life isn't as bad as we had thought, or maybe I'm not as dumb as I thought I was. No matter what, you have to have a clean solution. So armed with this philosophy, what we've been able to do is generalize our roadmaps to higher dimensional configuration spaces. First, we did it for a rod, which looks like a stick, and then we did it for a convex body and so forth. The idea being is eventually when we have n bodies, we'll have our snake robot. Our approach right now is to break the configuration space down into contractible regions. Regions inside of which we can define these nice one-dimensional representations, and then use the topology of the free space, of the workspace, to connect up these regions. So let me explain this with an example. So here we have this convex body over here. And I'll just explain via example. So this convex body, this is its workspace. It's just these two blocks with an outer exterior. And set of configurations we're going to look at now are the set of convex body configurations where you're 1, 2, 3-way equidistant. So that shouldn't surprise anyone because we need 3-way equidistance in R3. So as you maintain triple equidistance among these three obstacles, what we've done is we've drawn the configuration space here, but we're not constructing the configuration space to map out the space. We're just drawing this for visualization purposes. So you can see how as you move around over here, that corresponds to this purple line moving up in orientation. And as you'd expect, the set of triple equidistant configurations doesn't form a connected set. This is something you can't use for path planning. So we have to do something else. So if you look at this system long enough, this kind of looks like a node of the planar Voronoi diagram. So we actually use the edge of the planar Voronoi diagram to connect our triple equidistant configurations. So we call these convex body GVG edges, and these are called one tangent edges because they're tangent in some way. We generalize the notion of tangency for this convex body to go from this configuration to that configuration. And then the result is indeed a connected road map. So here we have a rod that's going around in three dimensions, and we have the convex body exploring this planar space. And we haven't quite gotten a three-link robot working, but we have a concave body with three convex pieces working. And this is a stepping stone towards getting multiple links going. So what's nice here is each of these edges and the nodes of these edges, they kind of introduce, if you use imagination a little bit, a hybrid control law that sort of says which way to go, which control law to invoke in order to explore a three or more, well, in this case, a two or three or four dimensional configuration space. So the idea is each edge in our roadmap induces a control law based on these distance functions, and then the nodes where these edges meet, that's the arbitration. That says, okay, you're done, let's invoke this control law. And then by going through and constructing this graph, you can explore space. Now, I'm not saying this is exactly how we do our hybrid controls, but it's a nice idea to keep in mind. So what I want to do is just take a small segue and start talking about position error. As you know, and I think everyone in this audience is aware of the simultaneous localization and mapping problem. It's sort of like a chicken and egg. If you have a perfect positioning device, mapping I don't think is that hard anymore. If you have a perfect map with great sensors, then localizing on that map I don't think is that difficult anymore due to the great results which some people in this room have done for us. But it's doing them together at the same time, SLAM, simultaneous localization and mapping. That's still a big problem. And the robot, in order to map out these spaces, has to know its location in order to say, hey, am I in new territory or is this someplace I've already been, to completely explore the space. Now, this community, this SLAM community, is very big, and lots of people address different aspects of it. And one of the aspects we're addressing is the idea of computational complexity. The idea is as the space gets bigger and bigger and bigger, if you're using common filtering, let's say you have to invert some bigger and bigger matrix. The idea that a lot of people have used is break the space down into smaller regions such that you can do SLAM in smaller regions where the computational burden isn't that bad, and then use a topological map, or use some map, to tie them all together. And we like this term atlas, which John Leonard and his students used, where each submap is like a map, and together they form an atlas. Of course, the map that we're going to use, or our high-level map that we're going to use, is the generalized Voronoi diagram. So just by way of example, again, here's the set of points equidistant to two objects. And then we'll associate with each edge a landmark. So the plus corresponds to the estimates to where the landmark may be located. And these ellipsoids, that reflects the uncertainty in position as to where the landmark might be. So here's another edge with its own set of landmarks. So now you can see how the generalized Voronoi graph is a nice map with which we can thread through all these submaps and put together a nice global map. What's also nice is that the origins of these submaps are very well defined. We have our control laws that guarantee we can always get to an origin. So this is our hierarchical representation. So when the robot goes and explores a space, in this case it's the sixth floor of Wien Hall, we're simultaneously generating a GVG edge with one control law, and at the same time using our vision system to look for landmarks in the environment. This camera system, by the way, is from Sanjeev's group, which we've got one of. In the old days, when we started our SLAM work, we used to have to put down little pink boxes all over the place, and that kind of solved a lot of our landmark identification problems because bright pink boxes are easy to detect. But we got better, and we're now doing some combination with the Kanadi corner detector and some SIFT features to automatically determine where landmarks should be, at least in these nice office environments. So what's going on is we're simultaneously generating a GVG edge and we're creating landmarks automatically on the fly using our omnidirectional vision system. Now, in the old days, what we did is when we got to a node, we would sort of look around and ask ourselves, does this node look familiar? If the answer is yes, then we'd say, OK, here's one candidate node. If the answer is yes, and we then list all the possible candidate nodes where we might be at. So then we move to a neighboring edge. Okay, we ask ourselves, does this node look familiar? And is this node adjacent to the previous node that looked familiar? If the answer to that question is yes, we would then move yet to another edge. So in a sense, what we were doing was formulating a graph matching problem with these yes-no questions. And until we got to something that looked unique, we'd say, aha, we know where we are. Or this is territory that's brand new, or territory we've already been to, and we can keep mapping our space. Since then, what we've been able to do is rewrite this hybrid topological localization SLAM technique on a discrete topology in a Bayesian framework. And what that's been able to do for us is now not only can we do localization, SLAM, but we can also address this kidnap robot problem. That's the problem where if the robot thinks he knows where he is, you pick it up and you just put it over here, it's sort of teleported. Well, and then the robot keeps marching along. All of a sudden, it's going to get very confused as to understanding where it's at. How does it re-resolve its location and keep going? So in writing this in this nice Bayesian framework, we've been able to solve more problems. Of course, we all know about Bayes' law. And this is our motion model, which is pretty simple. And then this is our sensor model. And our sensor model has in it the amount of edges that come out of a particular node, the equidistance, how far away we are from the nearest obstacle when we're at a particular node. And then this is the actual edge map that is coming into the node. So by simultaneously looking at this information and using our common filtering to create this edge map, we're able just to run our Bayes filter and localize ourselves. So let me give an example. So the example I'll give will be for global localization. So this is the sixth floor of Wien Hall. And just for argument's sake, let's say we're given a map of this. So when we start out, we don't know which node we're at. So each node has a uniform distribution as to where we might be. It's all equally likely. After moving to one node and invoking our sensor model, you can start to see that the likelihood of some of our nodes go down and some, I guess in this case, just survive. So now, after visiting that first node, we drive down to the second node. And after propagating a motion model, driving down the second node, you can see again we're a little bit less precise as to where we think we are. And then when we reinvoke the motion model again, we end up with something that's a little bit more precise. And we invoke the motion model in two steps. The first step was without the edge map, and the second step is with the edge map. And once you invoke the motion model with the edge map, you end up with a very unique understanding as to where you are. So what's nice about this approach is it manages the complexity. In other words, we're not doing SLAM in a large space. We're doing lots of little SLAM procedures. And for free, we're getting an exploration procedure, obstacle avoidance. And one of the problems that people really worry about a lot in worrying about SLAM is this so-called close the loop problem. When you come around a big loop and you end up exactly where you are, how do you know you've done that? This topological framework really hones you down very quickly. And again, this is a hybrid system. Now, where you're doing things topologically on one map, and then within a submap, you can localize to a fine precision. Now, the thing is, this only works when the topology of your environment is rich. Okay, that's a very polite way of saying this only works indoors. Where you have nice corridors, where you're able to sense to nearby obstacles and not be in large open spaces. So some of our work right now is worrying about the large open spaces. Position estimation is just one type of estimation that we've been working on. Another kind is the actual behavior estimation. And here we used Rex as the focal point. Now, conventional estimators, they deploy multimodal filters where lots of filters are running at the same time. And this suffers from some inaccuracy and obviously issues in scalability. So what we've done is we introduced this notion of a behavioral context where by looking at our sensory information, we can choose only a subset of the filters which could be running at any given time. And once we commit to a subset of those filters, what we're able to do now is, again, use our sensor information to pick the exact filter that we're running. So this gets around some of the scalability issues in that we don't have to run all the filters all at the same time. We're only running a subset of the filters, again, based on our sensory data. And it helps with the accuracy because we're not going to be averaging incorrect filters like the other systems would have. They're sort of thrown away at the right time. So what I want to do now is to sort of pop up a level to the big picture again. And again, remind you that a lot of our path planning work naturally avoids obstacles, but assumes we can control all of our internal degrees of freedom. Our motion planning work, that doesn't avoid obstacles, but makes the more realistic assumption that we can only control a subset of our internal degrees of freedom. And what we want to do is combine them together. So for the sake of discussion, we'll combine them together in this using just a single rigid body with non-whole number constraints as the example. So what we're going to do is we're going to lay down vector fields, control laws in the space. So instead of following an exact path, what we'll do instead is flow along a vector field. And this kind of makes sense, because you might think, well, can't we just use a path planner to generate a path and then use a controller to sort of follow that path? But with a little imagination, you can see that it would require a lot of control effort to sort of stay on that path. If we can lay down vector fields, then now it's just a matter of flowing down from start to the goal. So here's what we do. We use this notion of sequential composition that came from Burridge, Rizzi, and Kotacek's group. So simply stated, if you want to get to a goal, defining a nice funnel or a vector field that converges, that brings you to this goal is pretty easy. The problem is, what happens when you have obstacles? So what the sequential composition guy suggested is instead create a lot of little funnels that would fit among the obstacles, where one funnel carries you to another, and so forth. And then you form a graph where this control law brings you to this control law, much in the same way as falling into this funnel gets you into this funnel, and so forth. So this is why this is a hybrid policy, because you have a graph, a discrete graph, that's telling you when to invoke which control law. So with this in mind, one of our first accomplishments was we created a decomposition of the space. And inside of each cell of this decomposition, we're able to use Laplace's equations to define vector fields, which are orthogonal at the boundaries. And we just paste them together. Since they're orthogonal at the boundaries, they mesh up nicely. And now, if you want to go from start to goal, all you got to do is plop the robot down, and boom, it'll flow right to the goal. The thing is, this assumes that we have a fully actuated robot, and it also makes some polygonal assumptions about our space, which is hardly the case if you're actually looking at a robot that can actually orient, where its configuration space is actually SE2, this position and orientation information. So this sort of became a street fight because there was no natural clear solution. And what we've done is we've defined these control laws, which by their very definition respect the non-holonomic constraints, and then we just plop them down overlapping, creating our graph, our adjacency graph. But the thing that we lose is that we're not going to fill up the whole free space anymore. So we've lost some completeness. And we feel right now it's the best we can do. And right now, Dave is actually getting some experiments working on a logger robot inside Lewis Simon Hall. But here are some examples of where the robot started over here, and we told the robot to get here. And it just looked at all the policies, it searched the graph, and it just flows and does the right thing. In fact, over here, does a nice parallel park maneuver. And again, what's cool is if you go up to this robot while it's invoking the control law, and you just give it a push, that's OK, because you're just flowing along a vector field. You're flowing down the river. If you're perturbed a little bit, you'll just keep on going. If you're perturbed so much that you're thrown out of your current policy, that's OK, too. You're in another policy. You have this graph, and it'll guarantee you that you get down to your goal. So here's this big picture coming together. Again, we use snake robots as the application, as a target application. But there are lots of nice subproblems along the way that we're trying to meet. So we have this nice path planning work, which in a hybrid control framework, we're going to combine with our motion planning. But all this control still requires feedback, both in position and in the actual behavior that we're doing. So the next thing we're going to do is we're actually going to instrument some of those snake robots that the undergraduates worked on with some accelerometers to start to import some of the work we did in gait estimation. So here's our big picture of research. Each of these things have nice subproblems by themselves, but integrating them together is a problem that we're actively working on. So I call this my long-term vision as to what we're going to do. I'm really trying to change. Okay. Another future thing that we're really interested in is climbing. We want to be able to make these snake robots climb up spaces. So here we have this snake robot in a nice channel in the Purnell Center. And over here we have this snake robot, you know, gingerly walk up to a pole, hug the pole, and then run up it. This is something that we're not aware of other groups are able to do. And frankly, we don't even know why it works. So here's an example, again, of where the science hasn't really caught up to the experiment. All right. So we're going to take a step back and start looking at some of the fundamentals behind here. One of them is, of course, we're going to start analyzing the compliance. That's the actual interface between the mechanism and the robot. You know, I can tell you a story that, you know, on the side of this robot here, we have some nice soft stuff. And what happens is as the robot presses against the wall, it's able to unfold and create a nice surface area, letting friction do its thing to support the robot in place. And as it pulls away, the surface area goes down. There's no drag. It keeps going up. You know, that's a nice story. I think it's a good explanation. But I don't know if that's really what's going on. But we're going to start looking at some compliance models. The other thing is we're also going to start looking at the role of dynamics in climbing as well. This is more like what you see with a cat. Or Jackie Chan when he's climbing. Here we have this mechanism with an inverted pendulum with a mass at the end between these two walls. This by vibrating back and forth. By the way, this is at an angle. This is not a full G yet. But by vibrating back and forth, we're able to sort of jimmy up these parallel walls. And this is something we've observed. And now we're starting to begin to understand. So climbing is one area of future work. Now, I just want to change gears and talk a little bit about the other foci, this coverage work that we've been doing. You know, coverage is good for applications like vacuum cleaning, demining, looking for landmines. And the idea is if you can, you know, pass a detector over all points in a space, then maybe you can find all the landmines located in this space. In this room here, we developed this algorithm. Essentially, we divide the space into regions called cells, where coverage in a particular cell is trivial, simple back and forth motions. We construct a graph that encodes the adjacency relationship among these cells. And then by simultaneously covering, creating the graph, once the graph is fully constructed, you've covered the whole space. So you can see here we have a little light bulb on top of our robot, and we cover the space. One of the big challenges for making coverage work in a large space, you know, is positioning error. And you know, this is something I've shown before. Here, you know, over here is a run of the robot. This is sped up in the lab. The space is small enough where the positioning error doesn't cause us trouble. But in larger spaces, you know, positioning error just kills us. So what I had to do about 6 years ago was resort to using linear encoders. We actually built these little rings with fishing wire that comes out. And as the robot moves around the space, the wires elongate and contract. You measure the length of the wire, you know exactly where you are. But that's not a happy solution. Here, we started using vision. Again, detecting big pink things in space is easy. And by understanding the size of the ball and this dropping those balls down, instead of having wires, we now have these image cues, much like a sailor moving along a constellation of space of stars to sail can localize. And this is not what we're going to do. What we're going to do in the future is actually have multiple robots. Actually, we're getting three loggers. We have one of them now. We're going to have multiple robots look at each other. And by looking at each other, we're going to have them leapfrog through the space and maintain a good position estimate as to where they're located. Along the way in doing this, you know, again, we're using vision. And vision is very good at giving you bearing information, but not range information. And we've recently made this contribution to bearing-only SLAM using the iterated common filter. What makes bearing SLAM so hard using bearing information is getting your initial conditions set up just right. using this iterated common filter, we're able to, we're not sure why, but we're able to be insensitive to getting our initial conditions a little bit off. Right now, the robotics club is building a bunch of little robots for us to try some of these ideas out, again, using some coarse bearing-only SLAM. Another coverage problem that we worked on also was car painting. And the idea here was, we know robots paint cars, but it takes about 3 to 5 months to program those robots to paint the cars. So instead, we were working with Ford in order to automate that programming process. And that problem is a very interesting differential geometry problem, because you know, you have to worry about how the atomizer warps itself onto the space, onto the surface. You have to regulate the velocity of the atomizer as you go over the surface. You have to regulate the inter-slice index between the surfaces. And in fact, you have to be very careful as to what your first swath of paint would be on that surface. And what we've done here is, this is actually a little bit interesting. So if you're painting a flat sheet, it makes sense that you want to paint in a straight line, because the amount of paint that falls onto the left is the amount of paint that falls onto the right. If you're painting a sphere, you want to paint a great circle. Okay, you want to paint something that's a geodesic. The thing is, when you offset your geodesic, when you go to the next pass, you're going to accrue something that's called geodesic curvature, and this will add some lack of uniformity into your paint process. So the goal is, how do you pick the right geodesic, which when offsetted will minimize the amount of geodesic curvature, so you can maximize or minimize your uniformity. And taking recourse to the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, we realize you pick the curve in the middle of the surface. Really, what you do is you pick the curve that divides the curvature of the surface in the middle. And that makes sense, because when you start in the middle and you're giving your offsets the least amount of opportunity to accrue your geodesic curvature. What we've done is we've used this result to segment the car. So far, everything I've talked about is painting a simple surface, a car. As you all know, has complicated structure. So we want to be able to break that structure down again into subregions, just like we did with the planar coverage. Here, the first thing we're going to do is look for regions of high curvature and divide our surfaces or put relegate the regions of high curvature onto the boundary of these surfaces. So the idea now is if we do coverage within relatively flat areas, we don't accrue our geodesic curvature as quickly. Then it's a matter of just visiting each cell. Now, the segmentation process for the car, actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that. We have to use the same planar coverage algorithm that we used before for avoiding obstacles, but now to avoid holes. And this whole process allows us, you know, to go and paint what we call piecewise extruded surfaces. These are surfaces that are extruded surfaces, or almost like extruded surfaces, that are pieced together high curvature regions. And that's what this work was largely limited to. Right now, we're looking at using this work. We tried a little bit in automatic bone shaving, but we're also looking at ship inspection. The idea is that when a ship is going through some nasty area, a mine attaches itself to it, goes into port, and then blows itself up, and blows up more than just a ship. So if we can have a process or build a robot that can go and look for these mines, you know, that would be a great savings. The Navy is building these robots right now, and they're interested in using our techniques to guide where these robots should go. But you know, again, we want to see something work. So George actually is advising a little army of undergraduates to build a robot called Shallow X that will go in the pool and look for sea mines. Don't worry, there won't be any sea mines in the pool, so it's safe to swim there. Okay. I think I'm going to skip my class stuff because this video isn't working. But I teach an undergraduate robotics class where, again, we want to get the same mathematical theory and implementation smushed together, where the implementation helps teach the theory and the theory helps teach the implementation. And this is an educational paradigm, which I'm calling directed constructionism. You know, normally lecturing is a one-way process. You know, as professors, we get up, we explain stuff, and then the students go, they memorize it, hopefully they can regurgitate it on a test, and they come back and we hope for the best. What we're going to do instead is this alternative called constructionism, which came out of England, where you tell students, okay, you go build something. And by virtue of having to learn stuff in order to make something work, they learn some of the fundamentals. The problem with constructionism, I think the biggest problem, is it requires a lot of people. we don't have the resources. You know, the second problem, which is a side issue, is that you don't guarantee a full syllabus happens. So we're coming up with this hybrid policy where every week or every 2 weeks in my class, we give them something to build based on the principles that were taught in lecture, and yet they have to be motivated enough to understand those principles in lecture in order to build their device. So this is our hybrid policy, and for free, it actually gives students, like an electrical engineer, to understand how his field fits in a deeper context, and it builds team skills, particularly communication. I'm going to advertise using some of this Lego stuff. We started our first IC course for incoming first-year robo-grads, where they have to build something. And this year it was they had to build a robot that would go inside some marked region and then color the region as much as possible. Here's our winning team, Brennan, Kit, and I can't read who this person is, but she's not here, so that's okay. Mr. Zucker and Mr. Fairfield were really amazingly helpful, and so was Jason Geis, but they're not going to do this again, so we're looking for volunteers so now to help us next year with this IC. Finally, I mentioned in the beginning that there were these two foci that our research group was based on. One was things having to do with highly articulated system, and the other was coverage tasks. But this third foci that we're getting into now are these medical robotics. So certainly with these snake robots, we have to make them smaller. And of course, so you know, size isn't everything. Radius of curvature really is where it's at in order to get in. And we're going to add tools. But there's a lot of interesting path planning and navigation problems as well. Some people have worried about doing path planning for soft obstacles with rigid objects. We want to do the opposite, rigid objects, soft obstacles. And our long-term future is, we have on one side surgeons, and on the other side we have specialists. And what we're hoping to do with this technology, and others related to it, is sort of blur the boundary between it. We want to be able to make, we want to put the surgeons out of business. Okay, we want to make specialists do what surgeons only could do a long time ago, and hopefully surgeons will see the writing on the wall. I know Marco does, and wants to have more capabilities there. Now, cardiac surgery is one of the applications that we've been interested in, but lately we've been getting into neurology. Jim Burgess from Allegheny General has been talking a lot with us to do some spinal procedures again with these robots. Over the last year, Jim, people from the Pittsburgh Life Science Greenhouse, Marco, and some others, and Bronco, has formed this organization called the Pittsburgh Bioinformation Biomedical Group, Pittsburgh Big. And it's one of the few times that surgeons from Children's, UPMC, Allegheny General, engineers from Carnegie Mellon get together and they sort of brainstorm and then go off and write grants and hopefully do things. Final thing to let you know is we spun off a company based on some of this technology. So if any of you are interested in that, I can talk to you about the experiences. It's now running on its own. There's a CEO who's really great and everything. Okay, here are the topics that we worked on. We built lots of robots, and we looked at some underlying theory to make these robots work, as well as our underlying theory was inspired by these applications. And these are applications that we really care and work with. We are on a search and rescue response team. We work with Marco in the animal lab. And it's not just saying this is what we want to do. A lot of our theory has this combination of well-grounded theory and implementation. And this is something that I like to see in the education that we do. It's certainly in this introduction to robotics course. Also, this happens in this textbook that I co-authored with a bunch of people. But I like this well-rounded research program that we have, and I feel that Carnegie Mellon is one of the few places that has the people and then the culture to have this happen. Finally, I really want to thank. I have a credits slide. It's just not. My computer is being really selfish as to who. Okay, I want to thank. I've been able to work with a lot of people here over the years. And it's really great. I'm more than just standing on their shoulders. They're dragging me while I'm standing on their shoulders. And they're really great people, and I really want to thank them all. So thank you for your time and attention. If you have any questions, I'll take them. Yeah, Chris.
So I didn't understand on the SLAM part why a Voronoi deep method of generating something to hang the models off of was any better than randomly making points or doing a grid or doing a visibility thing. Every time you change visibility, you create a point. Or
right.
Why Voronoi mumble?
Okay. So the reason why is the submapping techniques right now, the way they decide, hey, let's create a new submap, is they wander around, and then as soon as they build up a lot of uncertainty, they say, hey, I'm lost, I don't know where I am, I'll start a new submap here, and then create an edge to the previous map. The thing is, as you're running around your space, when you come back to another submap, it's kind of hard to sort of say, hey, when do I ask the question, am I at another submap, and is this the same submap? With the Voronoi diagram, what's nice is those nodes of those Voronoi diagrams, when you get to a node, that says, hey, let's ask ourselves, are we at a new submap? Or hey, let's create a new submap. And the origin of that map is someplace we can guarantee that we're at. So when we start to do some of our matchmaking, we have a better fighting chance in order to correlate our existing sensor data with what is already stored.
So I can use that strategy to trigger these basically loop detection episodes. But, hang the maps off random points or something else. It seems to me those are two separate issues. Every time you're in the middle of what looks like a sphere, maybe it's the same sphere you saw before, is separate from, over here I can see the fireplace and the window and the door, and over here I can see two doors and a closet.
So maybe I'm understanding your point, and maybe what's going on here is something that's complementary. The idea is that the Voronoi diagram sort of tells you very precisely when to start to construct this map and guides your search as to when you've already been on another map. Now the thing that you're saying is, here are some other features that we can use to help do our further localization. I'm not married to the Kalman filtering in that edge map. We can use some other kind of feature-based localization scheme as well that would just dovetail in nicely. So maybe I don't think I'm getting your question.
We'll continue this later.
I appreciate that. Questions? No other questions? Yeah, Jack.
I have an incredibly naive question because this is not my area at all. With the mapping thing, you were identifying these points, but it looks like you were taking as a given some sort of global map. And if you're doing SLAM, where did that map come from in the first place?
Okay, so in that example I showed, I was doing global localization. I was just pretending I had the map in the first place. However, if we were doing SLAM, what we'd be doing is we'd be constructing the map, and we'd constantly be constructing the map. But as we construct the map, we'd ask ourselves, does this recent portion of the map look like something we've already been at? So actually, the map that you saw up there was constructed with a SLAM technique, actually. So what we're constantly doing is we're constantly asking ourselves, is this map, and we index it nicely because only when we get to nodes, is this a possible candidate map that we will have been to before?
And are you, in that diagram, you were selecting some key points for some decisions. So you're able to do that from just the part of the map that you've mapped out so far?
Yes. Yeah, thanks. All right, thank you for your attention.